talking to you a little bit about its performance parameters and what we've achieved over the last couple of years. I'm also going to describe what we've done in terms of upgrades this year and what we plan to do in the upcoming years. And then I'm going to show you some of our first science results, including observations of the bullet cluster and A2163. And then I'll show you the power spectrum, which we released Monday of this week. So brand new results from APEX-SC on that. It's been just a blast putting together the APEX-SC experiment. It's a collaboration based, with a marriage across the ocean with Bonn and Max Planck Institute in Germany and Lawrence Berkeley Lab, UC Berkeley in North America, which seeded the North American collaboration. As many of us grew up and went off to our own places at Boulder and McGill University, the group has grown. And then about a year ago, the Ancela Space Observatory joined as well. I do want to point out the contributions of a few people here over the last couple of years. Amy Bender and James Kennedy have been really influential in putting together our data analysis pipeline and being there just about every night in the field operating the telescope. Ben Westbrook is a new student coming on for the APEX-SC experiment, and then a number of characters which you'll certainly recognize here, including Bill Holzapfel, who's had a hand through all of this. So APEX-SC is mounted on the APEX telescope, which is a 12-meter on-axis Cassegrain grain telescope that was a prototype for ALMA. It's sited like many of the experiments on the Atacama Plateau at an altitude of about 5,100 meters. It's designed to be a sub-millimeter observatory, so its surface accuracy specs are much better than we need to observe at 2 millimeters. We have a 1 arcfinite resolution at 150 gigahertz, and it provides a very wide, roughly half degree field of view. Doing science up at 5,100 meters can sometimes be challenging. This is our fearless leader and principal investigator, Adrian Lee, driving up to the site using oxygen to make sure that he doesn't crash us and ruin our collaboration. And there's Martin Luker, a graduate student from Berkeley who also works on the South Pole Telescope, who's had a great role in getting the readout electronics and squid-based system together. So unlike all of the other cameras on the APEX telescope, APEX-SC is a PI instrument. So the people who built this camera, who operate this camera, and do the data analysis are one and the same. We had first light in December 2005. So the role of APEX-SC is first of all, it was designed to be a survey instrument to go after new detections of galaxy clusters. In sort of the post-SPT and post-ACT era, we've assumed a slightly different role, focusing primarily on targeted clusters. And you know, if you're trying to observe something on the sky that's a few arc minutes, and your beam resolution is an arc minute or so, it doesn't really matter if you have 1,000 pixels or 300 pixels in terms of your sensitivity on the night sky to do those targeted cluster observations. So this is a very, very powerful instrument for targeted cluster observations. Its other dual role, especially in this era of 2005, 2006, is as a technology pathfinder. APEX-SC was the first experiment on the sky to do millimeter wave observations and bring back real science with a large bolometer array with a multiplex readout and cooled without expendable cryogens. Now, that seems kind of ho-hum today because everyone who's followed in timescale after APEX has had these parameters and this technology. But much of the details and making this work was sort of on the shoulders of APEX-SC. And of course, the people who built the camera for APEX-SC are one and the same with the people who built the camera for the South Pole Telescope. So let me show you a little bit of that technology. Yeah, I see it here. Yeah, I'm fine. So the transition edge sensor detector array was fabbed at UC Berkeley by graduate student Jared Malley. He's now a postdoc at Chicago. It's a 330-element array, of which 280 of these bolometers are actually wired out to the warm, real world. It consists of, where's that hockey stick? It consists of six silicon wedges, much like the South Pole Telescope, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Each one of these wedges has 55 detectors on it. And for the science observations that I'm showing today, we typically have between about 140 and 180 detectors working on the sky. And that's very, very similar in terms of ratio to what I believe ACT is achieving and what the South Pole Telescope had in its first year or two. This year, in March of this year, we went down and pulled the receiver out of the telescope, opened it up, and extracted two of the wedges and replaced them with new bolometer wedges that are better optimized for what we're looking at. So as many of the instrumentationalists here will know, when you have a brand new instrument and you're going down to look at the sky, you're placing a little bit of a gamble. Okay, there's the sky noise to H nu P. And you would love to have that be your dominant term in your noise on the sky, but you have to be able to observe this power. And so your detectors have a thermal conductivity G and a temperature difference between the superconducting transition and the bath, which defines the total power that they're allowed to look at. So that's P sky plus some electrical bias power that you put in. You may not be quite sure what the sky power is that's going to actually arrive at your detector and be absorbed. You may not know what your optical efficiency is on the sky. You would also like to be able to observe under a variety of weather conditions, and you'd like to be able to look at calibration sources, planets, and so forth. So you would like to have a lot of liberty here to make P-sky very big, or to have P-sky be somewhat unexpected. Because if you exceed this in terms of your sky power, you're hosed. There's nothing you can do with your instrument. So when you first take it down, you'll find that most all of us have a G that's a little bit high. Unfortunately, there's another term in the noise, which is 4kT squared G. This is the noise that comes from heat flowing around inside your detectors. So you wish that this was zero, but it can't possibly be zero because you have to look at the sky. And because you're conservative and you don't want to end up completely hosed when you look at the sky, you always start a little bit high here. And so, of course, with APEX, with the South Pole Telescope, probably with ACT, we all started a little bit high with our G. We went out and understood our instrument, understood the sky that we're looking through and our calibration sources, and then we were able to go down and change the detectors to make G as low as possible so that we can optimize our noise. In addition to that, the bandwidth of APEX was a little bit narrower than we would have liked, so there were fewer photons that we were allowing to, well, they were actually hitting the detector but not being absorbed. And that affects the number of photons that we're bagging as well. So this upgrade in these two wedges improves the noise equivalent temperature from about 870 microkelvin CMB root second down to about 500. And that's where we'd like to be and where we'll be staying. So we've so far replaced two of the six wedges. After the observing run that ended about 2 weeks ago, we brought the entire receiver back to North America, and we will be replacing the other four as well. The combination of bagging more photons, having a lower noise floor, and having more working detectors should improve our mapping speed by about a factor of four. None of the science results that I'm showing today include those improvements, is that the data with the first two new edges is just weeks old now. So in terms of new technology Pathfinder stuff, we have the transition edge sensor bolometers and the multiplexed readout system as well. So the ACT experiment that Joe talked about a few days ago manages to run many detectors on just a single set of wires by looking at each detector individually. There's a snapshot of each detector, and so long as you cycle through the detectors before they've had time to change, so faster than their time constant, you're okay. You see everything that those detectors see. What we've developed for APEX and the South Pole Telescope is a system that multiplexes the signals from the detectors in the Fourier domain. So it's exactly the same thing as an AM radio, where you have many radio stations, many musical tones that are transmitted through one set of wires, the airwaves, and share that bandwidth. So that's what the electronics system for APEX-SC does. It's a squid-based system, so it uses superconducting quantum interference devices. And the devices we use are from NIST and exactly the same as the second or third stage in ACT. This is the first field implementation of a frequency domain multiplex system. And so this was developed at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, UC Berkeley, and now at McGill. And there is a new version of this development, which changes all of the analog room temperature electronics, and it's being used for EVEX, Polar Bear, and South Pole Telescope. So APEX was very important in defining that path. Actually, in our proposal, we did not state that we would have a multiplexed system. We thought that was far too ambitious to get funded. But fortunately, our development was on a path that we were able to implement that. The other important thing for APEX and all the experiments that were put into the field after APEX is to run the experiment without expendable cryogens. It really sucks to try and get cryogens from San Francisco to the Atacama Plateau, and that is the path they take to cool these experiments. So it's much better to use electricity and a mechanical cooler. And so for APEX, we do exactly that. And of course, that's kind of ho-hum today, as all of the new experiments are doing exactly that. So we use a mechanical pulse tube cooler to get down to 3 or 4 Kelvin, and then a three-stage closed cycle absorption fridge made by Simon Chase in the UK to get down from 4 Kelvin to 260 millikelvin, where the transition edge sensors live. So APEX, I believe, is the first experiment in the field to report scientific results with a pulse tube system like this. Okay, let's go on to calibrate the experiment and look out at the sky. So what's shown in the bottom left is a superimposed image of the beams of about 170 detectors. So each day we go off and map Mars. We calibrate Mars. Well, we know the temperature of Mars from the Rudy model of which we apply a correction from WMAP data. So they have observations of Mars that are accurate to about 1% or so. This combined with our understanding of our beams, which is at about the 4% level, temporal day-to-day fluctuations in the Mars temperature, which add an uncertainty of about 3%, and then the extrapolation of the WMAP measurements of Mars up to 150 gigahertz, which place about a 1.7% uncertainty, and a few other terms which are subdominant to these, give us an overall calibration uncertainty of about 5.5%. In addition to that, our beams have a slight complication. The main lobe of our beam is well described by our ZMAX simulations. It's an arc minute wide, but sitting next to that and below that, down about 25 dB below it, is a wide near lobe, which comes from light that arrives at the focal plane and reflects either off the Horn array or the filters that are covering the Horn array, bounces around inside the optics box, and essentially gives us a near lobe that's about the size of our array. That translates at small angular scales effectively into an uncertainty in our calibration and changes the calibration. So shown on the right-hand side are our beams across the array. And this is from data that is pre the March upgrade. So one of the things that's affecting our mapping speed is this one array in the bottom right corner, one wedge in the bottom right corner, which you can see has very few live detectors. So another example of why improving both the coupling and noise, but also the number of good detectors is going to vastly increase our mapping speed. The way that we look out at the sky is quite a bit different from what you've been hearing so far. The lore seems to be that you should stay at constant elevation and scan back and forth there. And if you're at the Atacama Plateau and you observe a field on this side and this side, that results in nice cross-linked maps. The lore isn't to go and modulate the atmosphere. That's exactly what we do, though. We're challenged in that we're trying to look at a very small area of the night sky with this massive array. And if we spent all of our time going back and forth and turning around this massive telescope, most of us are excising all the data at that turnaround as the telescope creaks and groans and throws itself back at some very high acceleration. So we would lose more than half of our observing time if we tried to look at a 10 or 20 arc minute object that way. So instead, what we do is we stare out at one point of the night sky and draw small circles on the night sky with a radius of about 5 arc minutes or so, and a period in the circle of about 5 seconds. So we play, well, the cluster that we're looking at is up in the sky. We walk up to it, draw 20 circles on the sky as it drifts through our path, and then we move the telescope up to catch up to the cluster, draw 20 more circles, and so forth. You can imagine what our time streams look like then. As each detector looks through a different elevation of the atmosphere, you get a cosecant response that looks exactly like that. What most people are doing is they're spending their time scanning back and forth to do their science observations, and then they go off to the side and do something like a sky nod to flat field their array and get an overall calibration. Well, we have that sky nod built right into our observation, and it turns out that fitting to this function is not much different from having to fit to a flat function to a constant, just to a DC level, right? At a constant elevation. Of course, our data doesn't look at all like this nice flat cosecant function, because there are large scale fluctuations, drifts, and so forth. So it actually looks like this cosecant function following through with some sort of a polynomial. So all we do is a joint fit to extract the phase, the amplitude, and period of this cosecant function at the very same time that we subtract out our polynomial. And that works very well. Okay, so our time stream processing looks something like this. We first find and flag out any pathological data where squids have jumped, cosmic rays, and glitches, and so forth. We then high pass filter our data. We're not really interested in the very large scales or anything that shows up in our time streams below about 0.2 hertz or 0.3 hertz in the case of the power spectrum. So that gets rid of our low frequency noise. We then perform the simultaneous fit to a cosecant as a function of elevation and a polynomial to get rid of large timescale drifts. And then finally, we address the atmosphere. Now, our beams are just highly, highly overlapping as they go out through the atmosphere and eventually diverge well above the atmosphere. So at the very first order, they're seeing exactly the same thing in front of the telescope. That's not quite true. You know, they aren't perfectly overlapping. So in addition to subtracting a common mode at each point in the data, we subtract, in the spatial domain across the array, we subtract a second order polynomial. So we do that for each snapshot of data on the night sky, for each moment in time. We then take our time streams. We use an RMS weighting and simply bin the data into maps that, for the case of the power spectrum, has pixels that are a third of an arc minute wide, and I believe for the clusters we were using 10 arc seconds. We then use a Markov chain Monte Carlo to fit to cluster profiles in the case of the targeted observations, and for the precision that we have with our data, the resolution and sensitivity, a beta model provides an adequate parameterization for the data. So we aren't claiming this is the right way to describe these clusters, but our chi-squares for beta model fits are perfectly good and do not improve for other types of cluster profiles. Yes, yeah. So here's the first result that was put out in July of last year. It's an observation of the bullet cluster. So this is a 23 sigma detection. And what's shown in the left-hand panel is the sum of all data. And in the right-hand panel is one of the jackknives we've done, which is the difference of every other scan. So a fairly convincing observation of the bullet. The Aztec folks at about the same time that we were studying our bullet data found a fairly bright point source at 270 gigahertz, sitting just off to the left and below here of the centroid of the bullet. Our fits to our the chi-squared of our fits to profiles for the bullet don't improve at all if we allow for a point source at that location. So we aren't able to observe any significant power for this point source at 150 gigahertz, which isn't very different from what you'd expect. If you now take our observation of the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect from the bullet cluster, which is the white contours that are shown here, and superimpose those on top of the X-ray surface brightness map, and then the weak lensing contours are shown here is in green as well, you come up with an image that looks something like this, and fairly nice as expected agreement between the SC and the X-ray. By assuming isothermality across the bullet, again at the resolution the resolution sensitivity that we have to the bullet cluster, that's probably not such a terrible thing to do. And taking the Chandra data from Klo et al. That's a couple years old, we arrive at a mass weighted temperature of 10.7 keV averaged across the cluster, and that can be compared to the X-ray temperatures. I believe that this is an emission weighted temperature from XMM and a spectroscopic temperature from Chandra. So reasonably good agreement there as well. More on the bullet. The upper left hand is the SC. The central panel here is the SC in contours and our beta model fit in color relief. And then what's shown on the right hand side is the residual between the two. And you do see some remaining structure off to the right. But that doesn't contribute significantly to a bad chi-squared. I believe the chi-squared here was something like 1.003, with a probability to exceed of about 40%. Okay.
I would guess that that's the other point, right? Or are you not making that inference, or?
It's not statistically significant. Yeah. So, you know, the first time we looked at it, yes. But if you apply statistics to it, it's not statistically significant.
Sorry. For example, for the mass weighted temperature, I mean, we actually use real surface density. So this is the beta model fit, but for mass weighted temperature, you don't have that position.
It's not wrong.
What the two problems?
No, it's not, because this is a beta model fit. And when we can do the mass weighted temperature, we reduce the real projected density as measured by Chandra.
Is that blob not too far from the center anyway? It's not in the position of the second component.
Well, it should be, right? The shock is actually leading the bullet. Mm-hmm. What do you expect? That the jump is actually sort of slightly, you know, on the right-hand side? I mean, but, you know, it's similar.
So
just tell you that
the scale, where he had the X-ray color image and the SC contours, that was about the separation of the two X-ray peaks in the previous map.
So given that it's not very significant, and depending, you know, exactly which week or which month in the analysis that we could have plotted this, we could have spent, you know, different amounts of time discussing it. We've chosen not to spend too much time interpreting.
You can turn it around and ask the question, if it's not significant, what does that tell you? The short strength and things like that.
Yeah, and I think with the resolution we have, you'll find that that's not a very interesting answer as well.
I think a future joint analysis of X-ray and SE data is we wanted to get a result out with the detection mean properties, things like that. I think there will be a more detailed analysis certainly in the future.
And this was a very clever step because everybody was observing the same clusters. And it was not to be so late.
Yeah.
As we had that conversation with more people, but please do not be late.
It's possible to bring that. That was not last.
Anyway, politics aside, let's move on to see what else we're able to do with the bullet and other observations. Okay, now by assuming hydrostatic equilibrium, we're able to to make a measurement of the gas mass fraction. We do that at two overdensity values. The bottom one here is chosen at a radius of 1.4 megaparsecs, meant to line up with the Zhang et al. With the Zhang et al. Measurement. We derive gas mass fraction from that of 0.17 with an error bar of about 0.03, and that's very consistent with what Zhang et al. Come up with as well. If you stay much tighter in at the inner radius to an overdensity of 2,500, the gas mass fraction goes up to about 0.21. There's also this result from Braddock, which is at 0.14 and uses kind of a hard to match area of the cluster.
This is all for age node of 70.
Sorry?
This is all for age node of 70?
Yes. Yeah, it's all for WMAP. Okay, let's move on to look at A2163. Also on the APEX telescope is the LaVoca camera. Martin Kotsov and Florian have made a very nice joint analysis with APEX SC and LaVoca. The APEX SC measurement of 2163 is shown in the left hand.
Can you go back for a second?
Oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong direction.
So the first line, so you're using hydrostatic mass estimate from X-ray, I assume.
So the big problem here is it's assumed isothermality.
Yeah.
You know that the Bohr cluster is not isothermal.
And also it's not in hydrostatic equilibrium.
Absolutely. So this is just doing the same sort of some of the very speculative assumptions we've done in some of the X-ray work. Saying how do we compare, but I agree that
the inner region, especially, so I'm just wondering that the top line.
You're probably seeing exactly that here. Yeah. Again, there's you know a limited amount that we can do with this resolution, but also with these time scales. And the bullet is just a walking signal that is a good first thing to kind of teach on an experiment like this. Okay, 2163. The image in the center here in color is the image at 350 gigahertz from LaVoca, and the contours superimposed on top of it are the APEX SC observations. The X-ray is shown in the right-hand panel as well. There is an offset in the centroid from the SC observations with respect to the XMM observations. That's about half an arcminute. So we could speculate about that as well, especially given what we've heard over the last few days about 1347.
Pictures of about 650 Three. Husbands and wives.
I don't know.
Okay. So with these observations at two different frequencies, we can go out and improve sort of the poster child. SC is their plot that you often see in the first few introductory slides of talks, and add the APEX SC measurement and the LaVoca measurement as well to provide a spectrum of 2163. With that, we can go out and try to simultaneously measure the temperature, the Y parameter, and the bulk velocity. Basically, with these three parameters, we have next to no constraining power. So we have to fix at least one of them. And so in the upper right-hand banana here, it's the bulk velocity across the x-axis and the y decrement across the y-axis. The dotted lines are what existed before the measurements of APEX SC and LaVoca, and the area to that those ellipses has almost half there with these added data points. If you choose then, so this is for a temperature of 10.5 kV fixed assigned. If you choose to use different temperatures, you can see how this error ellipse floats around in a space of bulk velocity and Y parameter. So this is a much lower temperature, 8, and this goes up to 14 kV. The analysis that we've done with 2163 is a little bit, well, quite a bit different from what we did for the bullet. We deprojected the SC and X-ray in annuli and measured a temperature as a function of these annuli, and so that's what's shown in this plot. the histogram and endpoints with error bars are the deep projected temperature profile, and this dotted line that sits at about 9.6 or so KV is what you would get from an isothermal assumption. Again, this is a very complex system that's thought to be a merger system as well. So, you know, this gives you some very rough feel for what the differences are for this type of cluster from assuming isothermality or not. We can then go out and measure the gas mass fraction, again, with the same assumptions as a function of radius. And that's the points with error bars that are shown here. Had we just simply assumed isothermality and still measured the gas mass fraction as a function of radius, we would have got the solid line here. The WMAP 5 number is the dot dash line here, and the solid box here is what was obtained by Squires et al. In 1997 from pure X-ray data. So that gives you a little bit of a feel for how, you know, going after numbers like this with a complex system like 2163 is varies through these different techniques. Okay, let's move on to the power spectrum. This is the work of Christian and Oliver and of course all of the APEX collaboration. It was released on Monday of this week, so brand new numbers and points to look at. It goes up to very high L, so we have data out to bin centers at about 9,000. The total power averaged across the bands that we observe is about 35 microkelvin squared, and that's roughly a one sigma excess above zero. This comes from observations of about one square degree on the night sky. The only frequency we have, remember, is 150 gigahertz. So we're not able to do any component separation. And we have one arc minute resolution. There's about 10 nights of data in this plot. So that amounts to about 3,000 bilometer hours. And the noise of this patch is quite deep. It's down at 12 microkelvin RMS per one arc minute pixel. It's centered on a bright cluster in the XMM LSS field, and we mask out that cluster for doing this power spectrum analysis. The total anisotropy across all bands is limited to about 105 microkelvin squared at 95% confidence level, and that allows us to set an upper limit on sigma 8 of about 1.2 at 95%. Confidence level. So that includes a joint fit for both the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect power spectrum and accounting for bright point sources as well. Note that when we do this fit, we do take into account using the simulations of Laurie Shaw and a whole mess of those simulations for non-Gaussian statistics. Had we not done that, we'll be fine. Had we not done that, we would have stated a limit of about 0.94. Okay, so most of the limits on sigma 8 that you see from power spectra like these assume Gaussian statistics, and the difference in our case between what we would have got and what we do get with those statistics is about a factor of 1.2 or so. The power that we measure average across the bands is 33 microkelvin squared, and if we also mask out in addition to that bright central cluster the brightest three sigma point sources as well, point sources defined by us, that changes ever so slightly to 36 microkelvin squared. The total power, assuming zero contribution from SE, would be about 1 10 to the negative 5 microkelvin squared in CL. That's roughly consistent with what you'd expect from various models of point sources, where these point sources are largely dominated by distant, dusty galaxies. The contribution that we'd expect from radio point sources at this frequency is about 20 times less. So everything that we see in the sky in the case of this power spectrum is consistent with these distant dusty galaxies. If we then take our result and combine it with the blast observations that were recently released at 600 gigahertz, we're able to make a measurement of the spectral index, which is at about 2.64, almost too good agreement with what you'd expect from the previous measurement from Mambo and Scuba of the power spectrum, of the spectral index of 2.65, and also what Knox et al. Arrived at a few years ago. So the power that we do see in this power spectrum is well accounted for by these distant dusty galaxies, and allowing sigma 8 to allowing sigma 8 to vary with non Gaussian statistics allows us to set an upper limit of just about 1.2. Are there questions or comments about the power spectrum stuff, John? Well, the measurement here is a measurement of power subtracting away our noise measurement. So, you know, with these error bars, depending where your noise is, you can also get points that are lower than zero and so forth. So,
well, yeah, that's, I don't find with that.
The point sources are found in the high resolution map, and they're not the dominant source of noise. There are a few things that three sigma, and they're or very subdominant contribution.
Oh, well, we should go no, I mean, I don't have any problem with point. I'm just curious, if I subtract the three sigma peaks, how do I get more power?
Because at some point, some people
negative
things contribute to the.
You're not subtracting, you're masking.
Well, I mean,
so
that's.
Yeah, so it's a different area. If you mask some area that happens to be around a zero sigma, then your power's going to. Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what is cluster mask? What do you mean by cluster mask? The first color.
Oh, so there's a bright cluster at the center of this XMMLSS field. We know it's there, it was there before we started looking at the field. and so we mask it out. Yeah. We've also masked out a second cluster that's observed in X-ray, and it shows no significant change in our results.
What is a solid line in that figure?
The solid line, I believe, is this is a sigma eight of 0.8.
Solid line is zero.
That's the dash.
Yeah. Oh, the solid line. Yeah.
Solid line. Okay. So since you're removing a cluster, then you're biasing all your sigma eight estimates, right?
Well, you have to be careful about how you deal with this, because we chose this field knowing that cluster was there.
It's okay for number one. It's not good for a precise detection.
But then I'm saying that. You don't. You cannot use Komatsu and Seljuk if you're removing your cluster. So that's that. Then you have to. I don't know, somehow model that in your power spectrum. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky when you go out and observe a part of the sky where you already knew it was there before you looked at it. So there's no, you know, how you handle
we
that.
We looked at the effectiveness of mock observations where we found similar clusters and recalculated the power spectrum, and the change was fairly small.
But
there's
like
a few percent level, which when you go to calculate something, it doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
And indeed, for the second cluster in the field, we tried masking it or not. Yeah.
Okay, that's
right. It really doesn't make a difference on the result. Okay, the future for APEX-SE. This is James Kennedy and Amy Bender down in the field about 3 weeks ago, bringing APEX home. So this is the APEX camera, and you can see that they have quite a strong motivation to work quickly and get things going. That's Kathy Orlu from Sweden. Once the receiver arrives back home, we're tearing out the remainder four old wedges and replacing those as well. We plan to run half of the wedges at 150 gigahertz and half of them at 90. So that'll give us some added spectral power, but horsepower as well, and about a factor of four improvement in our overall mapping speed. What's next? We already have a few dozen clusters on tape, and just some very rough map images of a few of those clusters in the right-hand panel. All of these are targeted observations of known clusters. We're going after the scaling relations. This is going to be Amy Bender's PhD thesis. Gas mass fractions, especially out to larger radii. We've included a number of high Z clusters in our sample, and we've adapted our circular scan strategy to go out to larger radii in the clusters as well. So this will be important in terms of constraining cluster simulations and calibrating what we're seeing with self-pooled telescope and ACT. Oops. Okay, so I think I'll just leave the summary up on the screen and see if there are any additional questions.
For your 2163, I was just wondering, you had the estimate of the gas mass dropping towards the center and there was a discrepancy. I'm just wondering whether if you were to relax the assumption of isothermality, and if I remember correctly, in this case, the temperature was actually right.
Yeah. So for 2163, we've done it both ways.
Okay.
This line is what you get for isothermality, and exactly what you've stated is what we get if we drop that assumption. So the red points here.
I missed that bit when you mentioned it. Correct. Sorry. Okay. So it works out what I thought it was.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the largest spatial scale that you, angular scale that you expect to be sensitive?
So it depends strongly on our scan strategy. So in the data that I've shown, it's about what, 15 arc minutes or so, 10, and we're expanding that out to 25 or so. So that's determined by our scan strategy and by our 1 over F noise, where we have to place that beam.
More questions? If not, then let's thank Matt again.